Hi, I'm Carmen LaBerge. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hello, friends. Welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Here on Connecting Faith, we are seeking to reconnect the eternal with the everyday, to be equipped to enter into the conversations of the day in ways that honor Jesus, to actually be people who are able to engage others in conversations about, you know, what people are already talking about, and to do so in a way that is reflective of the mind of Christ on the matters of the day. So that's what we're here to do. You can always connect with me on the My Faith Radio website. Connecting Faith has its own page. That's also a great place to go. Sign up for the podcast. And that's a way to share today's show with someone else. And I know that you're going to want to do that because my guest today is Johnny Erickson Tada. It's a conversation you absolutely don't want to miss and is one that you're going to want to share with others. So let's start off today just talking about the ethics of life, death, and suicide. Earlier this week, I think that, you know, we were all shocked by, you know, the headline news that fashion designer Kate Spade had taken her own life. And there's no easy way to have a conversation about that reality, about that truth. There's no way to overstate the grief that her family is experiencing. There's no way to make sense of that kind of act. And yet, when something like this happens, we as Christians actually have to talk about the realities of life and death and the ethics of life and death. And we have to talk about the pain in which people are living and the power of depression. And we also have to talk about the power of the gospel. Like, we have to be prepared in the midst of these very difficult conversations in the culture not to shrink back. We have to be the people at this point who lean in. Here was a woman at the prime of her life in every way. She literally, in every way by which the world measures things, she had the world by the tail. Rich, famous, beautiful, beloved. And yet. And so it didn't take very long this week for the conversation in some parts of social media to move to a pretty dark place. Did this individual, who was at the prime of her life, really at the pinnacle of her career, with a family and friends and rich and famous and all of these things, did she have the right to die at the time of her own choosing and in the manner of her own choosing? And if so, should she have been allowed to do that in a way that would have been more dignified, with the advanced knowledge of maybe her family, with you know, less public horror? That is actually the conversation that we're having when we're talking about legalizing suicide. The conversation about physician-assisted suicide is ultimately a conversation about whether or not any individual at any age, at any stage of life, in any mental or physical condition, possesses the autonomous right to determine when they will die and the manner of their own death. So don't be fooled. Don't be fooled by the way that people want to sanitize the conversation of, about suicide and about euthanasia. And when they frame it as right to die legislation, don't be fooled about what it's about. It is about a conversation in our culture about autonomy and whether or not every individual ultimately has the right to choose the time and the manner of their own death. If you look across the pond, France is actually looking at Belgium and seeking maybe possibly to follow the lead of Belgium on this issue. Euthanasia is once again under discussion in France. Lots of people in France are saying that their country should look to Belgium where the procedure of physician-assisted suicide, or actually euthanasia, was decriminalized in 2002. If you want to see the future of how physician-assisted suicide simply becomes euthanizing people against their will, and how it becomes something that is marketed to other countries, where people actually then travel to your country and check into facilities where they literally then check out. Look at Switzerland and look at Belgium. According to Belgian law, a patient can qualify for euthanasia if they are undergoing what they describe as unbearable physical or psychological suffering, not necessarily terminal, not defined by anyone as terminal, but defined by themselves as unbearable suffering. Now, as you can imagine, that is wide open to interpretation. Portugal just this week narrowly voted down the latest proposal to Parliament, which would have legalized euthanasia. But it's important to note they narrowly voted it down. So Portugal, appears to be on its way in this direction as well. Euthanasia's next step, or maybe the next step in Ireland, following its very recent passage of the legalization of abortion, or actually the stripping of their constitution of the protection of the unborn. Here's the lead in that paragraph. Hard on the heels of Ireland's historic approval of abortion in a constitutional referendum last week comes a bill to legalize euthanasia. Junior Minister John Halligan is working on draft legislation because he says he's been heartened by the public's response to the abortion debate. They showed, quote, courageous compassion, he said, and polls indicate they would endorse a right to die law. He also believes that there a citizens' assembly similar to the one preceding the recent referendum is needed on the subject of right to die legislation in the country of Ireland. Now, we're talking there about a supposedly predominantly Catholic country that that has moved in a direction on the protection of the preborn that is horrific, and now is already moving from the abortion conversation to a conversation at the other end of life. And if you have the right to take the life of a person in your womb, you certainly have the right to take your own life at the time and manner of your own choosing. And so these two things are linked. And so you say, well, what about here in America? Well, here in America, a very recent poll by Gallup that was done just in the first week of the month of May shows that 72% of Americans say that doctors should be able to help terminally ill patients die. 72%. So if you are saying to yourself, as you are listening to me right now, you know what? I actually think doctors should be able to help terminally ill patients die. You are a person who is a proponent of physician-assisted suicide. And this conversation is for you. Because from a Christian worldview, we do not have the right to be we are not the givers of life, and we do not have the right to be the takers of it, even of our own. And so we have to have this conversation. Now, if you substitute the language of suicide for the language of right to die, then that number drops to 65%. So even here in the United States of America, language matters. If you frame this as an assisted suicide conversation, 65% of us say, oh, it's okay, and we should be able to do it. If you frame it as doctors should be able to help terminally ill patients die, 72% of people here in America think that should be legal. And more than half of us think that it's morally acceptable. Now, what's interesting there is that more people think that it should be legal than think it's actually morally acceptable, which means that we have arrived at the place in our culture where we can acknowledge that things are not morally acceptable, and yet we think they should be legal. That's an interesting distinction. And I think that it's one that as Christians we should seriously think about. There is a steady growing support in the United States of America for physician-assisted suicide, or euthanasia, or right-to-die legislation is other language you'll see for it. And if Europe is any indication, then this will not end with those who are actively dying of an identifiable terminal physical illness. This will extend over time to those who simply want to decide for themselves when they perceive it to be right to die. And so we have to have this conversation. And that question of when is it right to die, that's actually the title of the new book by Johnny Erickson Tada. And she's going to be here to talk about this right after the break. So the question is, when is it right to die? And do you and I hold that right within our own hands? Or is the right to give life and the right to take it away still really held in the hands of the sovereign God? All right, I'm Carmen LeBurge. This is Connecting Faith. When I come back, I'll be talking with Johnny Erickson Tata. Friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I am very privileged to be joined today by Johnny Erickson Tata, and I am going to go ahead and start telling you over and over again the website so that you won't miss it. It's johnnyandfriends.org. The book that we're going to be discussing today is When Is It Right to Die? A Comforting and Surprising Look at Death and Dying. Johnny, thank you so much for joining us today on Connecting Faith.
Thank you, Carmen, and special greeting to all those who are tuning in.
So let's just ask the provocative question. I mean, it's in the title, but let's just ask it. When is it right to die?
Well, it's a good question, and it's a tough one because nowadays with conflicting medical opinions, people can get lost in a labyrinth of tubes and machines, and there's this growing trend that says just skip the suffering. Doctors today can easily put an end to your pain with a lethal drug. But even in light of all those issues, when is it right to die? It is right to die when it is time to die. Mm-hmm. And that is the challenge in this world of advancing and confusing medical technology. People nowadays, families, they have to find that line, that clear distinction between medical treatment that would obviously support your life, which is a very good thing, as opposed to treatment that would do nothing more than prolong the process of dying. There does come a place where people with terminal illnesses, with advancing illnesses, there comes a time when they do enter that irrevocable process of dying. And that's the challenge, to find when that process of dying begins. And Carmen, that's why I think it's so important for our friends listening to have a close relationship with a physician that they share the same life value with. I mean, you want to be as close to the facts as you possibly can get, right? Mm-hmm. And you want to be close to facts that are sensible, that can be translated and explained through a caring doctor who shares your life values. Because there are so many doctors out there, there's so many medical institutions where there's discrimination against the elderly. Our broken and profit-driven healthcare system is already playing undue pressure on people with terminal illnesses, disabling conditions. Even the media is full of calls to reduce, quote, heroic measures or late-life care in the name of cost containment. So you gotta make sure it's certain that you're connecting with a physician who understands those realities and will fight for you and will tell you the facts and will help you make that decision, especially with people who, in that close circle of confidentiality, people like your pastor, mm-hmm. your family members, people who know you well. So that I think, is a long answer to a very short question, when is it right to die? But it's an important answer, I feel.
Well, and Johnny, I feel like not only do you give us resources in this book that that remind us that, you know, not only do I need to be sure that I have a doctor who shares my life values, but that I've had those conversations with my family about what my life values are. And I've had those conversations with my attorney about what my life values are. And I think that if we don't know, I think a lot of people wouldn't be able to answer the question, like, what are your life values? They'd probably say, well, I'm pro-life. And then then we would say, okay, let's dig around in that a little more, a little more thoroughly. How far are you pro-life? Are you only pro-life, you know, on the front end of life? And if you're going to be pro-life, you know, when we're talking about natural death, is that your pro-life value? Because that's the way I articulate mine, that I'm pro-life from conception to natural death. Do you think that is an appropriate way of articulating sort of the parameters of a pro-life position?
Oh, yes, I do. Absolutely, Carmen. But the challenge is, when is a, quote, natural death? When mm-hmm. do those people begin that? When do we begin that process of dying? When do we enter that, quote, natural death? When God calls us home, we all hope for a quick and painless death. But as I said, in this day of rapidly advancing technology, our ability to make clear-headed decisions about something as simple as natural death can still get clouded. And that's why, Carmen, I'm so grateful that you let me have this time to just to share with our listeners how they might want to pick up this new book that I've written, When Is It Right to Die? Because I feel that it can give practical encouragement and biblical counsel so that people can make wise decisions. I think it's a valuable resource for every home.
Well, Johnny, it is. And again, friends, the book is When Is It Right to Die? And you can either contact us right here at My Faith Radio. You can email me at Carmen@MyFaithRadio.com and we'll send you a copy. Or you can go on the JohnnyandFriends.org website and you can read more about it. You can interact with some of the material and you can purchase the book right there. I think that everyone should be reminded that all proceeds go to help make life worth living for thousands of disabled people and their families. This is really, you know, at the heart of your ministry. And Johnny, one of the things that you say it's a new book, but this book is really a life's work over 25 years for you. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I first wrote it in 1991, when my own state of California was entertaining a proposition, a Death with Dignity Act. That proposition failed, but nevertheless, I went ahead and wrote this book to help people gain some clarity about these confusing questions and even sometimes more confusing answers. But the reason I updated it is because now we mm-hmm. have 8 jurisdictions in the United States. That's 7 states. That's Hawaii, Oregon, California, Colorado, Montana, Vermont, Washington, who have legalized physician-assisted suicide, and it's also legalized in our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. So there seems to be a growing premise that one is better off dead than disabled, or one is better off dead than being elderly. One is better off dead than draining the grandkids' college fund for health care costs. And these are dangerous premises, fearful premises. People are concerned about pain management. They're concerned about suffering. And yes, true, there may be suffering. Yes, there may be pain. But pain and suffering are not good reasons to establish a law. They should not be the foundation for social policy. It should not be government's responsibility to end people's lives. The responsibility of the state should be to help sick people, not provide for them to kill themselves.
Well, and I think that, you know, over the past 25 years, this has become not only, you know, more complicated as the state has, you know, maybe taken an increasing level of responsibility for, you know, for health care. And as we move in that direction, you know, as we have seen in other places around the world, when my health care is really up to the state, then the state has there's an incentive there for them to keep my, you know, either keep my life as short as possible, or certainly if I am only going to be a burden to them in terms of my health care, for them to promote me deciding, you know, that now is the right time to die. So can you talk a little bit about that, the relationship between health care and these kinds of issues?
Well, one of those points that aggravates this issue that you just described is that we live in an entitlement culture, which has largely been shaped by our radical sense of individual rights. Carmen, we can trace it all the way back to the 1973 Supreme Court decision in Roe versus Wade, when our federal judges determined that the U.S. Constitution contains in it an inherent right to privacy. Okay, so that meant people can kill their unborn children because they have a right of privacy. Well, if you extrapolate that out, this is what happens. Mm-hmm. People feel they have the right to privacy when it concerns their own death. And to me, this is a very radicalized sense of our individual rights. When we dress up our willful determinations, when we try to make respectable our will these things right, then we as a people become nothing more than a haranguing group of individuals fighting over who is more victimized than who. And then the exercise of these rights that become radicalized becomes nothing more than a national competition where people are no longer interested in the common good, but just on getting their own way, exercising their right to privacy. I have the right to determine the timing of my own death or the abortion of my child. So I hope that our listeners can see the connection between mm-hmm. that Supreme Court decision back in 1973 that attacked the sanctity of life, because we're seeing it played out even now as state after state legalizes physician-assisted suicide.
Friends, that voice you're hearing is familiar to you because you know her very well. That's Johnny Erickson Tada. We are talking about her latest book, When Is It Right to Die? A Comforting and Surprising Look at Death and Dying. You can find it at johnnyandfriends.org. I'd also, you know, recommend the Johnny and Friends website for just a wealth of other ministry resources for you and your family and your friends. One of the things I love about the book, Johnny, is all the stories that you tell of families, including your own family and certainly including your own story contained herein. But all of the stories that you tell about families who deal with these questions in such a wide variety of ways, why did you take that approach?
Well, I tell the stories of families because I feel that we all identify with personal issues that others are struggling with. And the stories that I tell in When Is It Right to Die are about people who have found that death with dignity is not necessarily hastening one's exit from life. These families have something to say, and in a warm personal way, I think they speak about their temptation to cut short the suffering of their disabled child or their elderly parent, but I think what they do say will surprise the reader. And Carmen, the other day I was reading a shocking statistic. 69%, this was a Gallup poll, 69% of Americans agree that physicians should be allowed to assist terminally ill people in ending their lives. 42% of evangelicals expressed the same level of agreement.
Wow.
And that was shocking to me, 42%. Now, this survey, I think, shows that Christians, we have a fundamental fear of suffering. We don't know what to do with it. We're frightened of pain and affliction. But fear, as I said before, should never be the foundation for laws and social policy. It shouldn't be society's role to help people end their lives. Most people, when they're at the end stages of life, are afraid of pain. They're afraid of abandonment. They're afraid of isolation. They don't want to be a burden to their families. Well, guess what? All these issues can be addressed. They are problems that do have solutions. Solutions like better pain management, better support services, better family counseling, and more. And actually, good resources for Christians in understanding God's sovereignty over pain and suffering. So let's not leapfrog to the quick and easy decision to cut short someone's life simply because there is pain and suffering, because there are answers to those problems.
Mm. Friends, we got to take a quick break. You're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm Carmen LaBurge. Joining me today is Johnny Erickson Tada, and we will be right back. All right, friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. Joining me today is Johnny Erickson Tada. You can check out her website, johnnyandfriends.org. We are talking specifically today about When Is It Right to Die, Johnny's latest book. And if you would like a copy, you can give me a call here in the studio, 877-93-FAITH, or you can email me, carmen@myfaithradio.com. And again, for those of you who don't know Johnny's organization, Johnny and Friends provides practical support and spiritual help for special needs families worldwide, equipping thousands of churches in developing disability ministry. And this particular book, I would say, equips individuals and families for the kinds of conversations we all have to be having today in relationship to, you know, the options that the world says are available to us in terms of making decisions about the end of our own life. And you and I as Christians know that is really God's decision to make. In life and in death, we belong to Him. And certainly there is a time to live and a time to die, but God is the one who is sovereign over all these things. So again, Johnny, thank you for joining us today on Connecting Faith.
Absolutely, and thanks for tackling this really critical topic.
So one of the things that stands out to me in the book comes from the 10th chapter, where, you know, we have this letter from this disabled, very depressed teenager. And I'm gonna read it, and then the question that's posed is, what would you say to this person? What would you say to this teenager? And I'm gonna go ahead and give a little spoiler alert to our listeners. This actually is Johnny's story. So this depressed teen who is making this statement is then going to answer for us the question: what should we say to someone who is in this circumstance? So the letter says, "To whom it may concern, I hate my life. You can't imagine the ache of wanting to end your life and not being able to because you're a quadriplegic and can't use your hands. After the doctors did surgery on my neck, I refused to wear a neck collar. I hate it too. Nobody understands and nobody will listen to me when I tell them I don't want to live. People feel sorry for me and I can't stand it. I can't even go to the bathroom by myself. I don't have the energy to cope. I don't have the strength to face the next day. I want out." How should we respond to her?
Well, you know, just listening to you read that, Carmen, brings tears to my eyes because I wrote that letter. Mm-hmm. I was such a depressed teenager, and you can understand. Our listeners can totally understand why I would be that depressed. But clinical depression has a cure. You can be cured of depression. I thought my problem was my quadriplegia, and that's why I wanted to end my life. I would ask my girlfriends to bring in their mother's sleeping pills or their father's razors. I was so despairing. But my problem wasn't my spinal cord injury. It was depression. I had no hope. I couldn't see the future. And that's why I'm so grateful that there were Christian friends. And that's the answer, Carmen. The answer is Christians speaking up, speaking out, standing by the bedside of despairing loved ones, ascribing positive meaning to pain, casting vision and hope when that person is despairing, you know, helping them see the future as a positive place where hope can be found, and plus underscoring that there's only one person who has transformed the landscape of life after death, and that's Jesus, the one who conquered the grave and opened the path to life eternal. And maybe a lethal prescription or maybe wrenching my head back and forth on a pillow would have given me a temporary reprieve, perhaps dying, but it is not the answer for the most important passage of anyone's life. And Carmen, I'm just so grateful that there were Christian friends such as those listening right now. You know, just average folks, didn't know how to, you know, connect with somebody like me as a quadriplegic, but they knew Christ and they knew that he was the answer. And they imparted that hope. They became the hands and heart of God himself standing by my hospital bedside. And when I got out of the hospital, they took me to the mall. They came over and had lunch with me. They took me to the University of Maryland and signed me up for classes. They cast vision. They cast hope. They ascribed positive meaning to my pain. And Carmen, that is the answer when people are despairing, when people are hopeless.
Mm. All right, friends, I hope that you are hearing what Johnny is saying. And what I hear you saying is that, you know, God equips us in the moment and in the relationships and through our relationship with him to bring hope into the midst of situations that we would never seek out, but which are very much a part of life. Can you give us some of the statistics, Johnny, on, you know, how many families across the country are we talking about who, you know, who have family members who are either physically or I would say also include the mentally challenged and disabled? Because we in our culture have gotten to the place where, you know, I'm not sure we're limiting the physician-assisted suicide conversation or the right to die conversation to just those who are physically terminally ill. I see it expanding, you know, to those who just don't think they want to live anymore.
Bingo, Carmen. You have just put your finger on the incredibly terrifying prospect that is before us as a culture, before us as a nation. Because right now, our physician-assisted suicide laws contain the law's extent just to people with terminal illnesses. But I can see the day when a despairing quadriplegic like me, and let me say that I'm so grateful that 50 years ago there was no Death with Dignity Act in the state of Maryland where I grew up. But I can see the day now when a despairing quadriplegic like me might just throw up her hands and say, I can't handle this. And maybe they might put forth a court challenge so that a judge might expand the definition of what a terminal illness might be. Kind of like what we're already seeing in Belgium and Luxembourg and in the Netherlands and even in Canada. I mean, I can see that happening unless we provide the answers to families now. Real quickly, just last month, Oregon is a state where physician-assisted suicide is legal. And just last month, the Oregon Health Authority, which studies and reports on Oregon's Death with Dignity Act, it stated this. Now listen to this. This is a direct quote. Any chronic condition which, if left untreated, would result in death within 6 months could be a terminal disease. So a terminal illness doesn't always mean stage 4 cancer. It could be muscular dystrophy, a disease which, left untreated, could take one's life in a short amount of time. Now, that to me is shocking. Most people would not consider muscular dystrophy as terminal. But if that individual decides to not treat his disease, then his case would qualify under the law. So our physician-assisted suicide laws in the United States are seen as permissive laws. And these laws do not compel patients to have exhausted all treatment options or to continue current treatment. If the patient decides they don't want a treatment, that's their choice. Oh, Carmen, just last week, my good friend, Vicki Olivas, she's a quadriplegic like I am. She met a woman in the hospital who became a quadriplegic. And within 8 months, the woman had killed herself by starving herself to death. Hmm. Now, when people see that, immediately they're going to think, well, how tragic. She should have been offered a lethal drug, something to put her out of her misery, but to starve to death? And that's the kind of thinking, that's the kind of situation, that's the scenario which will cause courts to throw open that definition of terminal illness to include someone like this despairing quadriplegic. And that breaks my heart.
Well, and Johnny, this latest, I don't know, it was kind of a revelation to me that, you know, you could actually get on an airplane and fly to Switzerland and check into an assisted dying clinic. And they will, you know, as an act of global service, they'll take your money and take your life. I mean, I was stunned. What was his name? David Goodall, who's from
right.
Australia. I mean, I was stunned by this. I mean, I had this conversation in the car with a 14-year-old, and I said, okay, you know, he's 104. And she's like, well, he's 104. You know, he's probably going to die soon anyway. And so I said, all right, now let's have that conversation. Just because he's 104 and he has no other, you know, life-threatening issues, you know, does he have the right to determine the date and the manner of his own death? And it got her thinking really clearly, because I said, well, what if there's a 30-year-old? Well, no. I mean, you know, they have a lot of life ahead of them. I'm like, how do you know? Like, how does any of us know? And so
right.
I think that one of the things your book does, and again, friends, the book that we're discussing is When Is It Right to Die? It's Johnny Erickson Tata's latest. You can check it out at johnnyandfriends.org. One of the things I love about the book is it provokes these conversations, and these are the conversations we as Christians must be having.
Absolutely. And, you know, as you were speaking, Carmen, I was thinking of Romans chapter 14, verse 7, which says, quote, none of us lives to himself alone, and none of us dies to himself alone. Right there, the verse is indicating that our choice, especially as it concerns end-of-life options, our choices always impact others, either for the good or for the bad. And a healthy society will always balance personal rights against the common good of the people. And as I said, when that personal right to choose becomes radicalized by physician-assisted suicide, then the exercise of those rights doesn't strengthen our society. No, it only alienates us from each other, separates us, and dismantles us as a people who truly care for one another. Physician-assisted suicide unravels the compassionate cords of our national character, which have for so long protected the weak and the vulnerable. So it comes down to this. There are good laws on the books throughout the United States which already help people die with dignity, laws which provide advanced pain management therapies, even laws that give you the right to refuse treatment should you wish. So do we want to help people die a good death? Well, if intractable pain is the issue, then, hey, let's pour more research dollars into better pain management. If fear is the issue, let's as Christians surround people, such as believers surrounded me when I was despairing. Let's surround them with spiritual community and improved hospice care. Because compassion is not placing a lethal prescription on a person's bedside table. No, no, no. Compassion is a Christian virtue, and it means ascribing positive meaning to people's condition and lifting them up out of social isolation and giving emotional support. And compassion is also gently helping them explore what lies for them ahead on the other side of the tombstone. That is the most important decision. You don't want people to wake up on the other side of eternity only to face hell and a dark, grim existence without God. If there is any argument for the Christian against physician-assisted suicide, believe me, that is the preeminent argument right there.
Absolutely. All right, friends, I can't highly recommend the book enough. It is When Is It Right to Die? You can get it at johnnyandfriends.org, and you can also give us a call here at 877-93-FAITH or email me at carmen@myfaithradio.com. We'll give you the copies that we have. But let me encourage you to go to the website, johnnyandfriends.org, and avail yourself of all of the resources that are there on the site, because in addition to this one book, there's just a wealth of ministry resources related to, I mean, I'll just tell you that as a parent who has a child who has some very significant challenges, our family has found resources on the Johnny and Friends website that that we didn't find anywhere else. And the kind of support that we then knew how to ask others for that we didn't even really know how to articulate. So let me just encourage you to make use of the ministry website and get a copy of the book, When Is It Right to Die? Be an advocate in these conversations, even as you have your own conversations with your own family, your own doctor, your own lawyer, your own caregivers about your life values. And be sure that your life values are shared by those around you, including a living knowledge of the one who died the good death that we might live, and that's Jesus Christ. Johnny, thank you so much for this book and this conversation today on Connecting Faith.
Oh, absolutely. If any of our listeners want to connect more closely, more locally with Johnny and Friends, you can do so by going on our website and looking up our Johnny and Friends office there in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Oh, see, for our local listeners in Minneapolis, they're going to be super jazzed about that. They may just drop by and say hi.
Good, good. Yeah. I would love it.
Johnny, thanks so much.
Oh, Carmen, I can't thank you enough. It's such an important issue, and you made it very easy to connect, you know, and understand. I'm really grateful.
All right, everybody. This is Connecting Faith. I got to take one more quick break. When we come back, we'll be making the connecting point. I'm Carmen LaBerge. You're listening to Connecting Faith. Hey, friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. All right, I'm interested to have your feedback, interested to know what you are thinking about these things. You can always email me, carmen@myfaithradio.com. You can hit me up on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LaBerge. These are conversations that we are going to continue to have here on Connecting Faith, because this is for each and every one of us a conversation that is deeply personal, and for which we should have advanced directives. Like, these are conversations we have to be having in our families. These are conversations that we have to be having with our pastors. These are conversations we have to be having with our physicians. On and on and on and on and on. And we need, as Christians, I would advocate that we need to be people who can say, not only in terms of how this affects other people, but in terms of our own lives, we need to be people who say, I am pro-life from conception to natural death. And then we have to be willing to say, these are the measures that that I believe are morally, ethically, and theologically appropriate in terms of the extension of my own life. We have to have those. We have to have those conversations. And so, let me encourage you to do that. And let me encourage you to not keep that secret or secretive, but to actually have the conversation. Like, death is coming. It's coming. I don't know when, but I can guarantee you it's coming. Death came for Jesus Christ. If anybody was gonna get out of it, it was gonna be Jesus. Okay? And he instead takes on death. You and I are still going to experience death, but we're also in Jesus Christ going to experience the newness of life eternally with him. And actually, in baptism, one of the things that we experience is that we have actually already died and we are raised with Christ. And so, yes, there is yet a physical death coming for each one of us, but spiritual life, a resurrected spiritual life, is actually available to you right now, no matter what the state of your health or the state of your body. Johnny Erickson Tada is a beautiful living demonstration of that truth. She's more alive and a more powerful witness from a wheelchair than most people who are, you know, defined as able-bodied could ever hope to be. And so I want you to think about that. I want you to think about the power of Christ at work that has raised her to a newness of life and to a profound witness in a body that has in every way betrayed her. All right. So quickly today, or here at the conclusion of today's program, I'm just going to take a moment of personal privilege. Tomorrow is my 50th birthday. Now, I don't expect anybody to do anything about that. In fact, I'm not a big party person. That's just not my thing. So, I'm going to go spend a couple of days with my sister. That's the way I want to spend my birthday. And so that's what my husband's made possible. So, tomorrow's my 50th birthday. And so I want to praise God, who is the Lord and the giver of life. I want to, really, I actually think that our birthdays should be a celebration of our moms. Like, right? I didn't actually do anything. Like, why are we celebrating my birthday? We should be celebrating my mom. So here's a little shout out to Ruth Ann. Thank you, Mom, for not just bearing me into the world, but bearing with me for my 50 years in the world. You are precious to me. Thank you. Thank you for all the ways that you have blessed me over the course of my life. And then I was reminded, I went to Africa. I don't know. It's been like a decade ago now. And during a worship service, so one of the things that's true about at least the part of Africa that I was in, this is Malawi, and we were working with an orphanage, it was just a nursery. They were just all little babies that don't have, they don't have any parents that claim them. A crisis nursery. And then we were also then going out and spending time with these orphan communities, because they actually have these virtually child-run villages because there just aren't any adults. So so we were in having one of those experiences in one of these orphan-led villages. And I was stunned by the fact that, like, they don't know when their birthdays are. There was nobody around to have birthday parties. There was no, that's not a thing. Like, they don't know when they were born. They don't know their birth date. They don't have birth certificates. I mean, it's really, when you think about the context of how differently people live around the world than we live here, it's stunning. But they do celebrate their rebirth days. And so, in the context of a worship service, there is a time during which everybody whose rebirth day, like, right, their spiritual birthday falls in that week, because everybody knows when they were spiritually born. Like, they know their rebirth day. They know when they came to Christ. They know when the reality of God's redemptive power became real to them and they received it conscientiously, when they made their own profession of faith. Like, they all know when that is. And they actually have physical evidence of it. Like there's a piece of paper and there's a baptism. There were these concrete events that much more real to them than the day of their physical birth. This is the day of their physical rebirth or their spiritual rebirth. And so they celebrate every week during the worship service, you know, if that's the week during which you were spiritually reborn, which means that, you know, you do have a rebirth day every year and you get to celebrate it every year and you get reminded every year that in Christ you have died and have been raised to newness of life. You get to remember and recall every year who the people were who, you know, shared with you the faith for the first time. And you get to celebrate the fruitfulness, the fruit that God has produced by the power of the Holy Spirit at work within you during the last year. Like that's what you offer. You come forward and offer your life again as a living testimony to the power of God at work within you. That's what you do to celebrate your rebirth day. And so there's all these young people up there of various ages, you know, celebrating their rebirth day. And so I do it on my birthday because, you know, I will say that in my experience of coming to faith, I can't tell you, like, I can't put a marker on the calendar of what week it actually was. I can tell you what year it was. I can tell you where I was, but I didn't mark it down as a specific date. So it was in early June, and it was in the year that I turned 16. And so I just go ahead and I just celebrate it on my birthday as well. So if you are looking for something to celebrate in your life and you are looking for a way to maybe make the faith more of a real celebration and blessing, like evidence that you really feel genuinely blessed to be a person who has a new life in Jesus Christ, start celebrating your rebirth day. I don't know when that will be for you. You can do what I've done, which is just basically give your birthday over to that, and celebrate your rebirth day, and maybe send cards and notes to the people who have been instrumental in your discipleship. So on my rebirth day, I send a shout out and a thank you to Kathy Connor. She was my young life leader when I was in high school, and she is the person who you know to this day I would point to and say, it would not have occurred to me that, first of all, I needed salvation at that point, nor would I have had someone to answer the kinds of questions that I was asking and to walk with me through some very difficult, realities of life had Kathy Connor not been a person who God had lifted up through the ministry of Young Life to walk with young people through that stage of life. And so, you know, on my rebirth day, Kathy Connor is one of the people who I thank and celebrate. She's certainly one of my spiritual mothers in the faith. If you are looking for a way this weekend to intentionally share the faith with somebody else, let me remind you that on Sunday is Harvest America. You can go back and listen to my conversation I had earlier this week with Pastor Greg Laurie. I think it was on Monday. So you'd go to myfaithradio.com. You'd go to the Connecting Faith page. You'd scroll down. You'd find the Monday program, which would be June the 5th, and you would listen to the conversation that I had with Pastor Greg Laurie about the Harvest America event and about not just evangelism but discipleship and what it looks like for each one of us to be used by God today in bringing forth the harvest here in the United States of America. So you can go to harvestamerica.com for all kinds of information, not just about the live event, which is taking place in Dallas, Texas, but how that event is going to be simulcast in hundreds of locations across the country on Sunday. And so there'll be ways there for you to participate and ways for you to get engaged. So again, that's harvestamerica.com. All right, friends, I always love to hear from you. So send me an email, carmen@myfaithradio.com. Visit me at my ministry website, which is reconnectwithcarmen.com. I'm also pretty active on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, and so you can check me out there as well. All right, friends, another week with you here at Connecting Faith. I love it each and every week, and I'd love to hear your feedback. I hope you are going to make it a great day. Have a great weekend, and God bless. Thanks for listening to this conversation from Connecting Faith. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend to grow the impact of Connecting Faith.
Also, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a conversation.